Thanks so much. So what is the purpose of this? This talk is specially designed for the optical lattices, and I hope if I get my message across, you'll find more things to organize by optical lattices. Now, as David pointed out, the impetus for this program is to a substantial extent from recent experimental progress. There's a lot of activity that makes it very interesting to look into the structure of circuits now. Maybe that is where the most progress is yet to come. It has been increasingly become more convenient to look at many neurons at the same time, something that theory kind of requires. It's looking back, it is not simple to see how hopeful you can enter a field when still most of the people are recording one neuron, at a time. And that is now rapidly giving way to many laboratories taking serious that nervous systems act through their collective dynamics. And then finally, and maybe the most exciting currently, is that over the past 5 years almost, like a revolution is happening in neuroscience that is going under the name of optogenetics, which for the first time really allows to play with network dynamics, not only to observe. I mean, physics has learned a lot. It started out as an observational science. If you were a current NIH reviewing committee and you look what Kepler did and Newton, it's only correlational. There's no interference with these systems. So not really a good study design. And that is what neuroscientists were unhappy for many years. They don't have really control, the interference, there's too much correlation stuff. And that is giving way, hopefully, by the advent of optical techniques. So of course I can't cover everything. I want to give you a few examples why, first of all, this is, we hope, ushering the golden age of network dynamics and population coding. And also why I at least think that theory hopefully becomes more and more informative for designing experiments. So I'll treat three different issues here, pars pro toto. One is how this optogenetic revolution came about, and so trying to tie its very beginning to its current stage, and there will be much more about this in the complete program. Then delve a bit into the propagation of activity, the dynamics of activity in intact circuits, and what recent theoretical work has unraveled as interesting mathematical aspects of that, and how it's there's an emerging, very fruitful experimental testing also of activity propagation in intact networks. And then if I manage, finally go to issue of interneural correlation, another problem where there's recent, really very nice theoretical progress, but also urgent need to address these correlations in measurement. So let me start with one. How do we get into this optogenetic business? It all started from bat botany. And I draw for you the star of the show, or at least the origin of the excitement, which is a green algae called Chlamydomonas reinhardi. This is a wonderful, it's Boris here. So actually it might also, this is a single-celled organism, eukaryote. It switches freely between asexual and sexual reproduction, so it may also be an interesting subject for Boris's evolutionary work. But it got center stage in neuroscience because it is an algae that swims. That's what these protrusions are. It does like breaststrokes, and because this is its large chlorophyll containing organelle, which generates or captures energy from the sun, this swimming single cell wants to be in the light. Not too much light to bleach its chlorophyll, not too little light so it will die of starvation. And they can do that. They swim and maintain a position that is very good for the light harvesting. And therefore, they were for decades a model system to study biophysics of vision, because one classical experiment in them showed there were blind mutants of those that cannot find the light. If you provided them with retinal, the chromophore in our eyes, these blind mutants would become seeing again and would be able to navigate their way to the light. And it was found out that there is what is called an eye spot, a light absorbing, a light detecting organelle that organizes the behavior of this creature. What it does normally is to swim in a spiral that is fairly straight and swims in a spiral towards the light. Of course, the experimental biophysicists would give
the micrometer size.
Oh, this. 10 micro. So, and it's electronically, presumably, a compact cell, which will be important. Of course, your usual biophysicists will not be happy to have the creature just swim to the light. So what the biophysicists in this field did was to flash it, yeah? Not put them in the aquarium near the sun, but turn on the arc lamp. And then this creature does something else. With normal sunlight, it swims towards the light. When you flash the arc lamp, it gets stuck and it swims for half a second backwards. And that response sets in within less than a millisecond after you flash the arc lamp. And through a series of ingenious experiments, Hegemann, Bamberg, and Nagel found out that there's a very fast current that originates from this single cell neuron I and triggers an action potential that is generated by these flagella membranes. So there was, in this very unnatural situation, where you shock the cell and it doesn't respond. Maybe if it swims in the California day from below a leaf and gets out in the sun, it wants to go back. But maybe it's a totally artificial phenomenon. In any event, there's a sub-millisecond kinetic current in this cell that drives its action potential and its response. And this has been called the photophobic response of this algae. And the big progress is that we can now transfer, or people that are not theorists can transfer this phobia from an algae to a mouse. And here's how that works. So there are two ion shells in this eye spot, one called the most popular is CHOP2, which is a transmembrane protein that can conduct sodium or calcium to a lesser extent from the outside to the inside, and potassium from the inside to the outside. It's an unselective ion channel with a reversal potential of around 0 millivolts. So it acts like, when open, like a synaptic conductance. But different from a synaptic conductance, it has a chromophore that senses light and can be turned on, can be opened by shining blue light on it. So you have like a synapse in the cell that expresses this thing, which is activated not by neurotransmitter molecules, but by turning on the light. So how do you transfer a botanical phobia into a mammalian brain? So I'll tell you one experiment that will be treated in much more depth when Michael Hauser comes 3 weeks from now. These are tools that are very powerful because they are genetically encoded light neuron actuators. And so what Hauser and his group, let's say this is a mouse, managed to do is to use this molecule to test one of the oldest ideas in theoretical neuroscience that we have. So the grandmother of all attractor neural networks is the Hopfield model. And so we also didn't find a new Hamiltonian, but the Hamiltonian of the Hopfield model, everybody knows that, is this. So we say this sigma is a spin that describes the neuron state. It can be plus one if the neuron's active or minus one if it's inactive. And John Hopfield showed us incredibly long ago that when you choose this
1982,
that when you pick a set of patterns and build the coupling matrix like this, Glauber dynamics of this, or the ground states, when you look at them, corresponds to the stored patterns. So these, there are a number, and P of stored patterns. And you can turn them into a synaptic matrix, and then this system will recall the stored patterns, will be capable of recalling the stored patterns, provided that the temperature is right and the patterns are sparse and it's better. And so there's a whole statistical physics of these. But the basic idea is that this type of system has features of memory because you can recall memory from partial information. You just see a person from the back walking and you recall, oh gosh, yeah. And so memories, and we are talking about adverse memories and specifically, can be triggered by very partial information. So that's the property of content addressability. So, and that's what Hauser and his colleagues seem to have proven in vivo using this molecule out of algae. So what they did was inside the brain of a mouse, there's a memory center that we all also share, the hippocampus. If you lose it, you cannot form new memories. That is a classical neuroscience result. And what Hauser and his colleagues managed to do is to get this channel here expressed in the input layer of this hippocampal structure. And not in each and every cell. They constructed a sequence, a construct, as they say, that has a promoter in front that makes this gene expressed only in neurons that recently underwent plasticity, that were strongly activated, that participated in synaptic plasticity. And then they put this happy mouse into a cage with a grid so that it could eventually experience foot shock, a light electrical stimulus. And they gave it also some music. And it's a classical behavioral paradigm.
So this is a
piece of DNA. Right. They electroporated it into a specific region of cells, the input layer of this of the hippocampus called dentate gyrus. And then it's sitting there, it's not being expressed. But this mouse has in these cells the capability to build, to put this channel into its membrane. But it will only do so in those cells that are involved in the learning process. Because the CFOS promoter is being activated specifically in strongly activated and neurons that undergo plastic change. That has been mapped out before. And now they put such a modified animal, a kind of a mixture between mammal and plant, into a box where it can listen to music and eventually feel some electricity. Not completely pleasant, but also not hurting it much. And so you play order of 10 times a tone, and at the end of the tone, give it a little foot shock, and then this mouse will know that this tone that is not good, yeah? And it will freeze simply by playing the tone. No foot shock, foot shock required. And the hypothesis is that in its hippocampus there is a cell assembly that is representing this memory, unpleasant memory, that after the tone comes the foot shock. But if this is correct, if you manage to put to get, instead of turning on the music, blue photons onto those cells, even if it's a small fraction, it might be enough to activate this reverberant activity. And that's what seems to come out just right. So then subsequently they implanted this with an optical fiber and were able to induce the same freezing response just by shining light on these neurons, selecting the neurons that were activated by genetics and driving them then later by this algal ion channel.
Without any previous training?
The training is listening 8 times to a tone that lasts a second and receiving a shock. But I mean, for the gene to be expressed, you need a couple of days. Yeah. So you have to, of course, they made sure that when you express it in randomly chosen cells, the light doesn't make the animal freeze. And recovering these brains, they have currently an estimate of that it takes 100 cells to be activated to recall this fearful memory. So that's like the
problem. Yep. Does that prove the harmful
amount? Oh, it doesn't prove it, but it proves that one can now start to play the games that can test it. So questions that one can now seriously ask is, okay, how few neurons do you need? Play with the protocol until you have 10 cells or one cell labeled or 1,000 and see how much does it take to trigger recall of a memory. You can try to image. People are working towards imaging many cells simultaneously in the hippocampus and see, do we really activate the same assembly by the perceptual stimulus and by this direct circuit manipulation. And questions like, so what I want to convey is that this is like the prototype, that the kind of dynamical picture that we developed can now really guide experiments and can be tested. How much evidence is needed to really prove it? Hopefully these criteria will come out of our program. But actually, so neurons enough? That is actually a large number when you have in mind a couple of other experiments that have been performed over the past 5-6 years. So also in rodents, Michael Brecht, at that time working in Winfried's Institute, showed that if you drive a single neuron in the motor cortex of a rat, you can generate a reproducible and reliable complex behavioral response. So what he probably for the first time did was to patch a cell in the motor cortex, not to record from it, but to control it. And in a couple of these cells that he had in the awake behaving animal intracellular, accessible, by inducing on the order of 10 action potentials in a single cell, induced a complex movement of its whiskers, one of its major sensory organs. And we heard that this is a very beautiful system to study active sensation. So this action, one essential action for sensing with the whiskers, can be triggered by inducing a few spikes in a single neuron. So it's actually important to go down here. Right?
But the neurons is enough to store a memory.
To recall it. It's stored by many more, I would expect. Who knows? Yeah. I'm not an expert in the hippocampus, but the recurrent circuit that potentially has this structure in it is not the dentate gyrus. It's the next stage that is more heavily interconnected than the dentate gyrus. So these cells, if they did it right, cannot be the ones that really recall. They can drive those that recall. Okay, so I wrote down Brecht because he showed us very convincingly that a single neuron is a powerful player in the cortical circuit. And 2 years ago, they even went more extreme and trained animals to report by pressing a lever whether a single neuron was stimulated. And with 5% success rate, they even found neurons in the barrel cortex, which the animal could realize. Oh, now this one neuron was tickled. I'll press the button. But how should we think this is realized? I mean, there are two extreme possibilities that you can imagine. One is that by making this one cell fire in a particular fashion, you entrain a large piece of the dynamical system to fire a certain sequence of events. And that is then encoding or leading to this behavioral output. Or you could think, well, maybe this precise spikes are not so important. This one neuron has 10,000 inputs to provide within the cortical network order of magnitude. So a little increase in activity in the cell could trigger a large rate response that then goes through this. So it might be a very fine control of the microstate. It might be an explosion of network activity. And so what can we say about that? I should get rid of this. Is it conceivable to have such a stable propagation of activity through a network that you can get it on a defined path by a small perturbation? And over the past 4 years, there have been a series of studies on cortical network dynamics that suggested this kind of thing. And Raul Memmesheimer, one of the main proponents of the theory, fortunately had time to come. So what they studied was, what they studied in this field is spike and neuron models coupled on such that we are sure by construction the collective dynamics resembles what is observed in the cortex. And that how to do that was worked out 1996. I first learned it when I came to my first ITP neural program here by Van Vreeswijk and Sompolinski. And there's a simple way to impose it. The scale, okay, the simplest of all networks that does this balances. What is balance in the balance state? Balance is an external excitatory drive, that's called E, with recurrent inhibition. So we have here synaptic connectivity, which now is sparse. So we have N neurons and on average K synapses. And they are, so most of them are not connected. It's a sparse synaptic matrix. But if they are connected, they are connected with a strength that scales with 1 over the square root of the in degree chosen like this in order to have the variance of the inputs independent of K in the large system limit. So you could build a mean field theory of this state that is guaranteed to work as long as K is bigger than one. So that central limit theorem things give you Gaussian statistics for the input currents, but also, so it's certain to work if the integral is smaller than n, so much smaller than n, but actually should be much smaller than log n. A really sparse network and classical work by Derrida, Gardner, and Sepelius showed that. So with this condition, in this network there are loops, but the first loop that closes after exponentially long time, and that's why the mean field theory is guaranteed to work with such a construction. Now what Raoul and others have done is to then study, for instance, their mathematical results are valid much more generally, but for instance, networks of integrated fire neurons with this type of connectivity. So VI is the membrane potential of neuron I, and it's a simple relaxation locally, but it's coupled by synaptic currents defined through this interaction matrix. So we sum over all J and the pulses of these neurons and T months a delay. So TPJ is the pth impulse generated by the neuron J. And this is guaranteed to balance the input by the recurrent interaction, because if you look at the mean current, what is it? It's square of kj mu, where mu bar is the mean firing rate in the network, but this is an inhibitory recurrence, so we have the minus in front, and then there'll be the external drive. That's the mean current into these cells. Now, in order to have activity in the large K limit, you also scale the input with square root of K, and so let's take this square root of K out of this bracket. That is the mean current. Why does such a system balance this by this? Well, otherwise it cannot be consistent. Let's assume that this bracket was negative. So the mean current is negative. If we send K to large values, this will become very negative. But it's only negative because the firing rate, cannot work. Can't be positive. But then this is smaller than this. So our neurons are not firing much. If you send K to large values, this will become very, very positive. So our neurons are driven really strongly. And therefore, the only self-consistent choice of this is that the bracket vanishes in the large K limit, meaning that the recurrent input cancels the external drive. And you can generalize this to excitatory inhibitory networks, and it works as long as, in some sense, in a very precise sense, inhibition dominates. So what Raoul did was, for the first time, have an estimate of the Lyapunov exponent of such a dynamics. Actually, in 96, Karl von Frieswijk and Chaim calculated the largest Lyapunov exponent and found that it was positive and infinite. So there was no Lyapunov exponent in their binary neuron model. And since then, people like Raoul and us have moved to study more realistic neuron models with the same connectivity. And what Raoul found was that in this network, there is irregular activity. So when you look into an individual neuron, it has, of course, a membrane potential as a function of time, V of t, that looks like a Gaussian process by construction. And because it is hitting the threshold only infrequently, and the correlation time of this Gaussian process is shorter than the inner spike interval, it looks like a Poisson process. But what they then did was, in a network of many such neurons, to move the spikes a little bit around. This spike an epsilon to the left, this spike an epsilon 2 to the right, and so on, and to study what will become of these epsilons. And to everybody's surprise, they found that these irregular states are actually stable. So you perturb it, it comes back to exactly the same sequence up to maybe a time shift. That's the only thing that it has. So it has one biasymmetry, one zero in the Lyapunov exponent, but all the others are negative. So you could actually should actually imagine in the state space of such a system there is a complicated trajectory from its statistics, looks like a Poissonian process driven by random noise, but actually it's a 1D attracting object. And if you choose random initial conditions, they will converge to a 1D attracting thing. Yeah? In their system, this was a transient state. And it can also become an attractor, and will become an attractor state in the large system limit. So this irregular firing state, according to these results, in spiking neuron models can be a stable thing. So one could imagine to entrain it to external inputs. Yep.
What is it? What's the modification in the model that allowed for getting rid of the positive eigenvalue?
It's the single neuron. So there's two things that seem to be that are important here. One is that you don't have excitatory. So you are getting ahead of. Can I comment later? So, but the neuron model is also.
Honest question. I don't remember. It's not.
Yeah. And it flies at the first sight into the face of the Hansel van Rijck. So this is all negative Lyapunov exponents and the. If the seminal paper had an infinite positive Lyapunov exponent. So obviously, what you get out depends very critically on your single neuron dynamics in such a thing. Yeah? So the small perturbations can be restored in such a complex state. That is a real achievement. And Raoul and co-workers showed that for actually independent of model class, for a very broad class of single neuron models analytically.
For this model, is it one basin of attraction?
I'll come to that. Yeah, whether there's only one such trajectory, maybe concealed. But I'll say something about it. But the topology of this attractor of this basin boundaries. Maybe we can make some progress on what one can say about that. But it's a very tough problem. So then Peter came along. Peter has been working like 10 years to talk experimentalists to do a very simple experiment that now should also be a piece of cake, but they did it in an extremely controlled fashion. So what Peter talked also group, people from the Hauser group into was, okay, to was it barrel cortex? I guess it was, yeah. In the barrel cortex to, like Brecht pioneered, contact a single neuron with an electrode and do experiments where you every now and then induce one extra spike. Rational being that if this one extra spike would generate in the first generation of postsynaptic neurons more than one extra spike, that would be a fingerprint of a highly unstable dynamics. If it was 20 spikes, it would be then 400 and so on. So a wave of of additional spikes running through the network, rather like the second possibility that I sketched. Yeah? Because there are so many synaptic outputs of this cell, manipulating a single cell might not be that small a perturbation. It may trigger a rate instability. And so what the rationale of these experiments, there's good estimates of the amount of charge deposited by unitary synaptic input. And so they tested under real life conditions, if I put this amount of extra charge like delivered by a single spike arriving, what are the number of spikes that I would get out of this cell? And then there are estimates of how many functional synapses there are in the local circuit. And with this data together, they could estimate how many extra spikes, and it came out about 20 more spikes by one extra spike in one cell. So consistent with a fairly unstable dynamics in the network. And that's actually, so you should never believe a result obtained one way only. They did a very nice check of this by predicting the rate response in the local circuit and doing this in a more advanced fashion, having a second extracellular electrode next to this cell. That's so allowed them by spike sorting to look at the local population and actually verified that there was a measurable rate increase in response to a single extra spike in the local network that was of the same magnitude as predicted theoretically, correct?
Yes. It's a randomly picked cell, or?
Yeah, randomly picked excitatory cell.
So you don't just try many until one responds, or?
So you're injecting current into the cell, so they always respond to current.
Yeah, but one will produce extra spikes, but most of them will.
So in a single cell, it was hard to tell. So we had to average over lots of neurons. So any particular neuron, there's a lot of noise, right? You have to build up PSTH for about 5 milliseconds, or so there's lots of noise.
So when I saw this, actually, I'd been following in the tracks of Raoul for a while with another student, Michael Monteforte, and when I saw Peter's paper, I thought we are doing this infinitesimal perturbations all the time, but this to have one extra spike seems quite relevant biologically. So we went to exactly this model actually, we made it simpler. We took the delay out, such that in the delay dynamic system you have infinitely many dimensions. So to be on safe ground, maybe it's even nicer to have no delay. Then there's a finite. So n torus is the state space, and you can calculate all the Lyapunov exponents. And we verified their results that when you take the delay out and make the network big, then all the Lyapunov spectrum becomes really, really very simple, graphing all the Lyapunov exponents against their index over n, so it's 1. There's 1 0 Lyapunov exponent, and all the others are 1 over tau m, minus 1 over tau m. So the Lyapunov spectrum looks like all the neurons are effectively uncoupled. Just their membrane time constant, that is the. So this is as stable as it can get.
If the condition for being in that regime is that there is no delay, then you know that the biological.
It's not a condition, it's just a thing that makes you trust your results.
Well, is it a necessary condition or just a sufficient condition?
It's neither necessary nor sufficient, it's just handy and increases tractability for the sake of tractability. You can have. So Raoul already showed it for stability for finite delay. It's just that you cannot get hold of the Lyapunov spectrum easily if you have infinite dimensional state space. That's why we choose the delay equals zero. And there is an instability if you make the delay long. That's a classical result by Nicolas Brunel, who unfortunately couldn't come, that you get an inhibitory delay-driven fast oscillation in the rate. Oh, that's what we didn't want to study. Yeah? So we have an extremely simple and stable as you want dynamics, but still you can do the same, play the same game as Peter did. Actually, it's not obvious that you can, because this is a purely inhibitory network, and so where's the spread of activity? But you know there can be this type of instability too. Yeah? So what we did in these simulations then is to stop the transmission of one spike that would be normally generated. And so when you graph the distance, well, this is now, so we have two states, Vi and Vi dash, the one after leaving out one spike. and your average, we'll call this V dash, and you graph it against time for, you can do that for the tiny perturbations that just shift the spike times like Raoul did, and then you have an exponential decay of this D with time, with the rate 1 over tau m. When you leave one spike out, you get exponential separation. So this is a finite perturbation, and the rate of this is now, as far as we can tell, order k nu bar. Also that's a plausible rate for things to run from each other. It's a rate of input bombardment. Yeah? Meaning that in this, okay. Yep.
Was the rate proportional to the number of extra spikes caused by an emitted spike?
No, that could be, so when you take k large, the number of extra spikes goes essentially to, actually here, goes to zero.
Number of extra spikes is zero?
Because your response function becomes ever faster, so the rate response becomes very fast for large k, and that's why the number of extra spikes goes down. So it's a macroscopic instability, I would think. Yeah? So this is actually, but the number of extra spikes is not related to this. So it's not a Lyapunov exponent. The Lyapunov exponent is defined for an infinitesimal perturbation. There seems to be some critical k, some critical distance where you run across kind of a Bayesian boundary, but then the trajectory is. So in these, you can call it flux tubes. Yeah? So within a single flux tube in the state space of the system, you converge to a unique trajectory. But there are Bayesian boundaries of these trajectories. And when you get into the next one, they form a kind of spaghetti that run apart exponentially. And if this was this consolidates, it would mean that in the same system where you have locally stable dynamics in the large, in the thermodynamic limit, you would get an infinite Lyapunov exponent. There's a lot of dynamics to learn to really get a good handle on such systems, yes?
Does the distance saturate after some time?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah, you can predict.
What's the time scale for the saturation?
It's the same, yeah? So this will saturate on to the average distance on the invariant, over the invariant measure. And that can be calculated by mean field theory and comes out perfect.
So do those Bayesian boundaries correspond to the point where you miss a spike or add a spike?
What would you say?
They correspond to interchanges of spike times.
So a core part, a technical condition for Raoul's theorem to work is that these perturbations are so small that the ordering of spike events is not perturbed. So you can have a size of perturbation where you switch spike times and then you are in a totally different ballpark. How much time is left? 10 minutes? Okay. Then the third part should probably start right now.
If I have one question, will you just take excitatory emitter inherent, so the exponent for positive, right?
Yes. This is really, it's not sure. We should discuss this more thoroughly. Yeah. But Sarah asked for what is the conditions to have this complex dynamics be stable, and things for which you get stable balanced state are integrating fire or like integrating fire like neurons with only inhibitory synapses. There's a study that shows if you add a few excitatory circuits, you can still, it won't move the largest Lyapunov exponent above zero. I mean, it should be there should be some smooth dependence of these Lyapunov exponents on the model, and you turn on excitation slowly, you don't run into chaos right away, I would expect, and there's evidence for that. Yeah. But the single neural model is also essentially, you can stay with the same dynamics and replace the integrated fire model by the theta neuron, by the normal form of a saddle node bifurcation, which is also at least as plausible neural model as the simple RC circuit. And then even with pure inhibition, we have conventional chaos and unstable dynamics. And we calculated the Kolmogorov-Sinai entropy, so information loss rate, and it comes out really high, yeah, like 1 bit of information lost for every spike in the network, yeah, which is about the same amount of information that one thinks can be stored into a sensory spike. So that's a nice playground for dynamics and statistical physics, and it's a kind of playground that we start to share with experimentalists that perturb cortical networks. It's not behavior, but it's something that is really relevant for how these circuits operate, whether they are highly unstable and a single neuron action can trigger a system-wide rate response, or whether there are very fine-grained information in the spikes. That's an issue that one can now start to really work out, going back and forth between much easier simulation experiments than in the past and a theory where we have a formalism and an emerging structure for the dynamics of these large systems. So the third thing I wanted to briefly mention concerns the study of correlations. And I have to be very brief, but it's also a very simple thing. Why did I want to do neuronal theoretical physics? This is the most, if you are looking for strongly interacting multi-particle system in biology, why not the brain? Okay, so one would think, well, let's study correlations. And when you look at spike-spike correlations, and these are strongly connected networks, so there should be signatures of these neurons talking to one another. But the hunt for correlations is very successful, and it finds correlations that are really, really low. Those spike count correlations, if you have 0.1, it's a large number. We will have another visitor, fortunately, this week, Jason Kerr.
What time interval are the spike?
Like if you average over, this is cortical, yeah, a mammalian, and if you take the average spike count over 50 milliseconds, that is what many people do. A recent paper by
Ken. 10. Hmm? You chose 10 instead of 50 milliseconds.
They don't go up much. So the real thing would be to look at the conditional firing rate or your correlation, spike correlations, yeah, which is hard to estimate. You have to get a lot of spikes. But then, the latest Ken Harris paper is an attempt to estimate those, and there's a little bit of modulation, maybe at best of the order of an increased rate on the order of the mean rate, which is low. So the current consensus is that making the window short will not give us much higher correlations. But it's also understood that when you average, you can average out, because the correlation function can have an undershoot, and then you can have zero count correlations and still substantial spike correlation functions. Well, so if you want to learn more about this, I would recommend to go to the talk of Jason Kerr, who pushed the technique of calcium together with Winfried and Zachmann of obtaining spike patterns simultaneously in many neurons in best behaving preparations to the limits. And they had all the analysis machinery ready, looking for hubs that trigger things in the entire network or SIM file chains. And when the data came in, they wrote a very simple paper that the correlations are really low, that they couldn't find any sign of propagation. And then they had first time wake the animal up and the correlations went further down. So, and if I had time, there's also a corresponding theoretical work that, so that I cannot treat, but you should see, Raoul and we and Peter, all of us have been simulating balanced networks in computers. And in some papers that are really well done, okay papers, they simulate a balanced state with a few hundred neurons. How can you satisfy with n equal 100? Well, this cannot be the reason why this game is working. And through simultaneous discoveries by John Hertz and Renard and Ken Harris and Mr. Paga, I think, is the leading theorist in this. At the beginning of this year, people had really worked seriously through this mean field theory with correlations and found that there are additional dynamical mechanisms that force correlations to be low. And
Art, yep. When you say correlations, I mean there's some distance scale between them?
That's a mysterious thing. So people that graph correlations, so this correlation coefficient between 1 and minus 1, yeah, between say spike count, and you graph distance on a millimeter scale. I don't understand it really well, but the people that show you these graphs have a really weak dependence, suggesting that a substantial amount of the stuff that you get as correlations are global state changes. So there's a distance dependence, but it's weak, and it's the correlations that people can see are really long range, indicating that they are not local circuit signatures. But one striking thing, and that's extending throughout, that's not only in the cortex, also in the retina, is that overall correlations are low. That doesn't mean at all that there are no statistical dependencies between the neurons. And they're also low in this model neurons where you have only 1 degree of freedom. So correlations are very complicated and have attracted a known theoretical experimental subcommunity, which is represented this week by Elad. And so if you want to learn how to get hold of statistical dependencies in multineuronal recordings that are not well diagnosed by pairwise correlations, then please come to Elad's talk. And I think I have exhausted it. Yeah.
Dave, when you talk about correlation as a function of distance, yeah, what do you mean by distance? You don't mean where the
distance between the neurons along the...
But yeah, that doesn't tell you what you really care about, which is connectivity. Yeah. Distance in the sense, is there an axon going
on the... Yeah. Yeah, but... absolutely, you are totally right. Yeah, one should measure distance on the graph. But so far, people are able to tell. And the Baer and colleagues, which produce such kind of graphs, they work in monkey visual cortex, where there's believed to be a sensible relation between local circuit and distance between the cells, and still it doesn't.
Well, there is a higher density of local connections, but there's still an overabundance of loops that allow you. You know, we learned from Valentino Breitenberg years ago that if you start from a neuron and you make 3 steps on average, you'll be able to come back. Mm-hmm. So it's still part of the local circuitry, local in the sense of your connections, but not local in space, because these connections could take you to another column.
Absolutely. That's one thing to conclude with. Laura Sarah's point is very, very well taken and is really important. So it shows that the correlations will be a theme of this program. And it also reminds us that these local circuits may not be there. So one paper that I find very interesting came out last year, Armin and Stefanians try to estimate, fairly successfully for my taste, estimate if you take a millimeter diameter cylinder of cortical tissue and ask in the center of it, you grab randomly an axon, where does it come from? In a local circuit picture, you would think it should come from within this. I mean, a millimeter is really big. But 60% of the axons that you grab come from outside of this cylinder. So local circuits have to be taken with a big grain of salt.
Do you know if the correlations are equally bad if you throw away the spikes and just look at membrane potentials?
With membrane potentials, you can get larger ones, really large if there's state changes like up and down states. But also for fluctuations, Ida and Lampel reported that there's more correlations in the input than are transmitted in the output. But so that's another mystery. That's a very interesting point.
Just one comment that in our field, there were, of course, people who were thinking about somehow getting over the knowledge from neural networks to the quantum systems, okay, and try to somehow solve the problems like, for instance, quantum memory problem, which is how to store the information in the network, you might say, but not only in terms of patterns like Kevin was in Hockley model. So let's talk for a moment about static models, not the dynamical models. But there are also quantum fluctuations around this pattern. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more sort of story. But anyway, maybe we should at some moment think about making an informal discussion about these things, because maybe we could learn a lot from you from this knowledge that you have about this stuff.
That would be very much in the spirit of this institution, I guess. So thanks so much for the suggestion. I think now everybody has done lunch but me. Yeah?